Great readers are less common on Earth than great writers, and most of these readers, the few that exist or have existed, are completely unknown to us. They turn their pages in silence and rarely share their thoughts.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Peter Orner about his book, Still No Word From You, Notes in the Margin, published by Catapult.
I particularly love the people who wrote in the margin, you know, and that was the working title for a long time, because that's what I'm really doing, is thinking in the margins, not just on the page, but about my own life.
This book of essays and intimate stories meld the lived life and the reading life for Orner, for which there is no separation.
I mean, to me, I would say that it isn't just the essence of being a writer. I think it's really the essence of all people who tell stories. You know, this desire to translate experience that has impacted you in some way and tell other people about it.
Orner demonstrates the connection of a reader and text as collaborative. In one example, by featuring his grandfather's unanswered letters from the war, providing a response some seven decades later.
In the letters, he often begs her to write him back, to tell him what's happening at home in Chicago. Please, Lorraine, can't you put a pen to paper and write to me? He's wearing those big glasses and the glare of the morning sun flashes off the metal frames. My grandfather's wide forehead and perfectly round head. Not totally bald, he had a sheen of hair that covered his head in thin parallel lines because he spent every morning combing them. He wasn't a vain man. He only wanted to pay homage to what little he had. July 10th, 1945. My darling, another day and still no word from you.
Peter Orner, Still No Word From You, Notes on Literature and Life. Welcome to Arts and Letters.
Oh, thank you, Brad. So good to be here.
It is so fantastic to have you here. We've been trying for this for so long, and I just admire your work so much. But I would imagine that it's very hard for people to pin you down into any categorical sense. And you write, it seems to me the most honest way of constructing a life, a gathering of fragments. That's what you're doing here. Am I right or wrong?
I find that I beat myself up all day for not working. And then the way to somewhat deal with that sense of shame is that I take notes. And I take notes on stuff I'm thinking about, stuff I'm remembering, and stuff I'm reading.
Let's listen as Peter Orner reads an excerpt about the writer, Jean Rees.
I think of that time after she vanished. The fact is, she didn't. Being broke, drunk, and out of print didn't mean she didn't exist. We know she was constantly hard up and moving from town to town. Her mental health was tenuous, her drinking nonstop. At one point, she went to jail for throwing a brick through a neighbor's window. She'd had a reason. The neighbor's dog murdered her cat. And in spite of it all, we know that she kept working, or at least trying to work.
I'm really interested in these pieces, in particular with Jean Rees and also Richard Wright. Do you find yourself drawn to the stories about the writers as much as you do about their writing?
I'm just fascinated by the question, because my initial thought would be that, you know, I'm just interested in the work itself. But as you point out, I am interested in the life. And what I try and focus on is to work off of the cliche or the sort of oft-told stories of people's lives. you know, Gene Reese, obscurity, poverty, drinking, and suddenly rises like a phoenix with Wide Sargasso Sea. Her story is often told on book jackets as if she rose from the grave in 1966 with the typed manuscript of A Wide Sargasso Sea in her nearly dead hand. It makes for good myth. The sad facts aren't so clean. She was very much flesh and blood and, like everybody else, consumed by gnawing needs. In 1979, the year she died, Reese told an interviewer, "I'd planned to die at 30 and then push it on for 10 years further. You always push it on. And then you go on and on and on. It's difficult. I've thought about death a great deal. One day in the snow I felt so tired. I thought, damn it, I'll sit down. I can't go on. I'm tired of living here in the snow and ice. So I sat down on the ground, but it was so cold I got up." And Richard Wright, less told but fascinating to me, is that he ended his career writing haiku in Paris. When he was dying in Paris, Richard Wright wrote haiku. A lot of obvious things have been said about this. He was tired out, and all he had left was the energy for a few lines at a time. Wright said to himself, in a letter to his Dutch translator, he wrote, "During my illness, I experimented with the Japanese form of poetry called haiku. I wrote some 4,000 of them, and I'm now sifting them out to see if they are any good." I tried to imagine my way into those spaces, trying to think of what it was like to be such a powerful novelist, in Wright's case, somebody who was business was sentences and plot and movement. And what does it take to give all that up? And think, all right, I'm going to contain myself in this ancient structure of haiku. Wright speaks of his illness in the past tense, but I'm not sure it ever went away. To his agent, he wrote, "These poems are the result of my being in bed a great deal, and it's likely that they are bad. I don't know." It is September, the month in which I was born, and I have no thoughts.
So these would be almost your thoughts in the margins, but fully expanded.
Right. It's thinking on the page for me. In a way of desacratizing, if I could use that made up word, this idea that what you're reading is sort of like written in stone. Every morning, I would just think about what I'd read and jot down some notes.
One thing I think is interesting is the idea of this to me being notes. So it does have a kind of commentary feel, which is a traditionally Jewish, you know, religious school kind of thing.
And it's not like I sit around reading the Talmud all the time, but I do love the structure of it. I love the idea of commentary and commentary and commentary.
What's your identity as a writer with respect to being Jewish?
I make it real clear, always to myself, and I'm always a little, maybe not uncomfortable with the idea of being labeled, you know, but I find that that kind of limitation on the imagination can sometimes be stifling, you know? So I'm a Jewish writer some days, and other days I'm trying to break free. And, you know, not to quote Kafka here, but he did say he had enough trouble being a human being.
So tell us real quick, what does Kafka, unlike the rest of the legions of folks who have read Don Quixote, what does he figure out?
It's hard to distill. Should I read some? It took 400 plus years of people reading the book for one grown man who lived with his parents to read it in a German translation and reveal what was in front of everyone's faces all along. Sancho wrote it. Why else would he be unable to fully immerse himself in the fantasy? not only does he have less fun, but his bruisings and clobberings are no less real for having been invented. More so because he, Sancho, unlike Don Quixote, actually feels them. This is the price you pay for being the wizard, and yet the genius of Sancho is that nobody ever suspects it's him telling the story. Often even he forgets. Maybe he'll get that governorship of the island out of this deal after all.
I love that. I love that because we think of writers providing for us amazing insights. But in this case, the reader is the one who writes about the amazing insight.
It's Kafka's invention. If there's anything that's important to me, it's the independence of the reader, you know? And that's what Kafka asserts here. The absolute independence. What I find more and more, you know, as being a sort of a problematic thing out there in the universe, is that people feel the need to have some type of assistance or guidance in terms of understanding what they read. And I feel like we really need to reassert the independence of the reader.
So the reader invents as the writer invents.
Yeah. It's a creative collaboration between reader and writer. Is Ferlinghetti a great poet? No, never was, still isn't. But he must have made my mother laugh more than once, and that's gotta count for something. And as I read my mother's copy of A Coney Island of the Mind, I feel it. Life on the page, which is all I can ask of any book. Now and always. An experience recently with my mother, and the piece starts, if this was gonna be a story, it would be called this. But you know what? I'm not gonna do that. I'm just gonna tell myself a little bit about what I think might have just happened. And I left it at that. And you know, maybe that's a trick, maybe that's actually a story, I might argue, but I was trying to say, look, we don't always have to create some kind of arc.
This is J. Bradley Minnick for Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with author Peter Horner and listen as he uses his notes in the margin to bridge the gap between reader and writer, as he reclaims and examines his family, his grandfathers, his grandmother, his stepfather, and himself.
I do in some ways, but I don't really think of you as a confessional writer. In this one, there's you.
I'm on a bench in a Little League dugout. My dog is peeing on third. There's a lot that's death-like about the geometry of baseball. You start at home, and if you're lucky, you return home. If you're not lucky, same thing, only quicker. Either way, you end up back in the dugout. In the center, equidistant from all the bases, a mound of dirt rises like a year-old grave. None of this has anything to do with Kafka. I did read once that he was into sports and used to work out naked in front of his bedroom window. He also said, in a letter to Felice, that he didn't want to be a hermit. He just wanted to be dead. Not because he craved suicide, but because he felt being dead would help him concentrate better.
And what about this idea of coming home? It's a beautiful metaphor, the metaphor of the baseball field. We start at home and we end up at least thinking about home. This book is a lot about thinking about home, not just place, but home.
You know, this idea of circling. You circle the bases, right? If you're so lucky to be able to get a hit and move forward. But I was sitting there and I walk the dog every day at Huntley Meadow near my house, and you know, I often sit in the dugout, which is also what a wonderful place to be. What a wonderful idea. What sports has like its own house? You know, I just think this idea of returning, and I do think that I was circling back to home. I think that's, which is, yeah, you know, often what I always do. But I think that in something inside me in the last year thought, you know, it's okay not to reinvent again. You know, you can trod territory you've already trotted. During the war, my Massachusetts grandfather was in the civil defense. He carried a gun not much bigger than a cap gun. His responsibility was to make sure his fellow Fall Riverites had their windows properly blacked out. He would walk the streets of his own neighborhood, from Delcar Street to Robeson to Dudley to Highland Avenue, and hunt for light. They wouldn't send him overseas. He was 4F, back trouble, feet flat as pancakes. But my mother told me he'd painted an old leather football helmet silver, and he would practice an authoritative face in the bathroom mirror. And if, on his nightly rounds, he spotted a crack of light beyond the blackout curtains, he'd march up to the door, knock on it with 5 authoritative knuckles, and inform the violator in no uncertain terms that they were aiding and abetting the enemy by providing an opportunity, a target, a beacon for the Luftwaffe. Grandpa Freddy was a mild-mannered guy, but give anybody a gun, no matter how tiny, and something to enforce, and he'll lug the weight of the world across quiet lawns. My grandfather making his rounds for the civil defense. I think of him often, walking his streets, murmuring happily to the trees, put out the light, and then put out the light. My work in general bounces back and forth between my two grandfathers. I have my Chicago grandfather who fought in the war, and my Massachusetts grandfather who was in the civil defense. My grandpa, Fred Kaplan, all my Walt Kaplan stories are based on him. My grandpa Fred died at 59 when I was about 8 or 9 years old. You know, he's someone I never got to know as well as I would have wanted to. But even so, he's kind of this indelible presence in my life.
So what was it like to grow up in Chicago as an introspective kid with parents who seemed to understand you, particularly your mother, and your father to some degree, and then these characters that are your relatives?
My grandfather, I mean, he was that city, even though it really wasn't his, but he claimed it. He claimed it, and I think my grandmother did too. My grandmother was a showgirl, a dancer, throughout the mid to late 20s and into the early 30s before she had my father. She danced at the Oriental Theater at McVickers. I have a stack of her publicity photographs.
What a great photo of grandma dancing in the shows. One foot is on the floor, her other foot is behind that foot, kind of as a bent knee, smiling at you with this gray hair. She's young, she has the world in front of her. Tell us about this woman, because it's just stunning.
My grandmother was a showgirl and dancer, professional dancer in Chicago, from maybe her late teens through her kind of mid-20s when she got married. There are many of these photographs that I think were used to, you know, help her career. I mean, I have a stack of them at home. So there are many of my grandmother in these these are remarkable poses. You know, I've even tracked down the studio that took the pictures. I mean, this was part of the gig. My dead lookout windows. So many of these windows are gone. I'm not sure it matters. 814 Lunt Avenue. 322 Fargo Avenue, 78 Pine Point Drive, 513 Hillside Drive, July 10th, 1945. My darling, another day and still no word from you.
The dead look out windows in these stories. Your dead look out the windows. Are they always looking out windows?
I'm very preoccupied with space and the way that the places we live, the apartments, the houses, the rented apartments, you know, that we spend so much of our lives in, you know, and then leave. I'm just fascinated by the way that we carry those places around. It's a literal thing that I look out windows of houses that no longer exist. I mean, I can do it right now. The house I grew up in no longer exists. I can look out the back window. out the kitchen window at the backyard. And I can see the Schur's house through the trees. And I know you can do that, and everybody listening can do that. The relationship between physicality and memory for me is very, very strong.
That's beautiful. The book does deal with you. How would you locate yourself in relation to this book? Because you're on the periphery, you're the center of it, but most of it is you telling stories about people you love, you know, you admire. How do you locate yourself in relation to Still No Word From You?
I've always sort of written against that, you know, but of course I'm there. You know, I'm there in every line. This is my second foray into writing nonfiction. And in the first one, I said I'd never do it again. And here I am, you know, in very few years doing it again. But I find that there's something about writing nonfiction, attempting to write nonfiction, attempting to tell the truth, that I find an interesting space to work in, because I usually have this infinite options, you know, possibilities when I'm writing a story. I can say what if. And, you know, with writing about true things as best you can that you have firsthand knowledge of, I find sort of is a certain containment that I think can make for, you know, some truth. You know, and I'm uncomfortable talking about myself on the page, but I'll do it if I have to. February in Chicago. Cemetery trees. Skeletal tangles. Pallbearers aren't called upon to carry anymore. Must have to do with liability. Sue the mortuary over your pulled muscles. The casket rode on a kind of gurney. We pushed it a bit, together, and then the grave workers took over, yanking the gurney over the rough spots, roots, stumps, graves. The family plot was about a tenth of a mile from the road, where they, again these men, unloaded the casket from the hearse. We gathered under the small yellow tent in the wind, in the lightly blowing snow. Aside from the plastic chairs, there were two chairs covered over with a plush velour-type material, little thrones in the front row. Rose Hill Cemetery is on the far north side. The cemetery is huge. It stretches from Ravenswood Avenue to Western Avenue, and yet you could drive by it for years and not notice it. How it is with cemeteries. You never think you need one. I watched the grave workers, how they stood hatless beside the casket, snow whitening their hair, as they waited for the rabbi to finish what the rabbi needed to say. All are from the dust, and all return to the dust. Rose Hill is non-denominational. They've probably heard every speech there is here. The grave workers stood there motionless, like brothers to the trees. Of the scene, and yet invisible to us. My daughter held my mother's hand. The two of them sat in the plush chairs. An open grave is exhilarating, if only because someone else is about to lie in it. The grave workers lowered my stepfather with a small portable crane. One of the men operated the crane while the other two or three guided the casket with gloved hands. The casket hovered and we all watched it, attached by a hook to a cable. There isn't an elegant way to do it. There was the noise of the crane. There was the fact that the men had to lean over the grave in order to line up the casket without falling in themselves. I'm sure this has happened many times. Think of the stories these guys could tell. They used to talk, my mother and my stepfather, deep into the night. I'd be trying to sleep in the little guest room at the end of the hall, and the two of them, 3, 4 in the morning, would be chattering like birds. My brother and I had been worried for a long time. Dan was 11 years older. We tried not to think about it. Isn't this what people do? You can't pre-break your heart. And then the phone calls from the hospital, last-minute flights. Suddenly everybody knows what to do. My 9-year-old daughter holds my mother's hand. The crane's small motor burbles to life like a lawnmower. They lower Dan without incident. There was no thud. And the men, the 3 or 4 men, backed away. They left the equipment and backed away into the trees.
Do you have any advice for readers when they read this?
They read anything, you know, and I tell this to myself as much as to anybody. You know, just slow it down. You just gotta breathe a little. Maybe that's a key to it. Not to get all, like, yogi on this, but it is a sacred act. That's what I would say.
Well, Peter, thank you so very much for this.
Thanks, Brett. Thank you.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to the following musicians and singers. Spencer Kenny for the cool jazz. And thanks to Kazunori Tanaka for the trumpet sounds. A super special thanks to Spencer Kenny for producing, mixing, and mastering the program. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Peter Orner for your notes in the margin that bring together memoir, essay, amazing storytelling, and the best kind of reader. Careful, close, and considerate one. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Franz Kafka. You do not need to leave your room. Remain sitting at your table and listen. Do not even listen. Simply wait. Be quiet, still, and solitary. The world will freely offer itself to you to be unmasked. It has no choice. It will roll in ecstasy at your feet. Arts and Letters is a production of Living the Dream Media.